Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Benjamin Weissman. He's the author of a new second book of stories called Headless. His first was called Dear Dead Person. His new book, Headless, is from a imprint called Little House on the Bowery. It's in paperback. It's an imprint of Akashic Books. And Little House on the Bowery is a series of books that Dennis Cooper is editing for the Akashic Press to try and stimulate the growth of new and surprising fiction. Does it, Dennis, represent any particular aesthetic in general? Is it a specific aesthetic that you're looking for?
No. Things that I think are brilliant or extremely worthy that I don't think would have a chance in sort of mainstream publishing is essentially the only criteria, and that they aren't too published, you know.
The authors aren't.
Yes, and that it's not an age thing, but it's if someone, there are plenty of writers who published many books who are deserve to be better known, but I had to concentrate on writers who haven't published that much or are very young.
How many books have been in the series so far?
This is the second one. They're due 2 to 3 a year, and Benjamin Weissman is the number two.
You have known his work for a while, as we have all known one another for quite some time. What is it, I guess the two of you can answer, it's been several years since Dear Dead Person. Is that because there's a difficulty getting published, completing work, doing work of this type? What is the, you know, what leads to your turning as a writer to a new press?
Well, I think that, you know, wanting to work with Dennis was a big thing. And I think the time in between books is that, you know, I was writing stories the entire time, but the assembling of a manuscript is sort of like a different problem. And I think when Dennis approached me, I could sort of put one together quickly. And prior to that prompting, I was just sort of like, you know, roaming from one story to another and accumulating 50 stories, you know, in a kind of non-manuscript sort of, you know, pile. And he kind of like shaped it into something kind of organized and in four parts. And yeah.
The four parts seem to go from violent men to sexual men to the subject of families, and the second section is a kind of different set of stories for you, personal stories, stories mm-hmm. that are stories about events that feel at least like they've begun at some level of reality. So in other words, the book feels like a guide to the sensibility, re-violence, re-intimacy, re-sex, and re-family. But what's funny is that although the stories have a recognizable voice, they don't seem to define their author. Are they meant to?
Well, no, I don't think they're meant to. I think they do. I think some of the stories are probably things if I was an essayist, I'd probably write an essay on watching my friend die or something, and I don't really want to write essays. So I think they became material for stories, but they had a much different like flavor and tone. And then I thought that some of those earnest pieces would work well with things that were completely over the top, that were, you know, purely imagination. But I think that the book is, I hope the book's better than I am and sort of more interesting than I am, and sort of like all the, you know, like a kind of compressed version. and has, you know, sort of I think that's the whole point of writing, is to sort of like get it all out of yourself and in this very condensed way, that when you're a person, you're sort of diffused and speaking kind of like I am now, and when you're writing, you can be like really exact.
Now, it seems to me that in the stories, they're so wild and they're so funny. Nothing, it seems, at an extreme, can't happen in them. What are the limitations on these kinds of things? Why do they stop when they do in terms of ending? And why do they stop when they do in terms of morality?
Wow, on the morality. Yeah, I don't know why they stop. I probably just run out of gas. I feel maybe that they're like, I feel like I'm, the stories are like little arguments, and I feel like I kind of am standing there and I'm sort of just trying to like argue my case of set of problems that come up in the story, and then I'm done. And I, you know, I think I like I like the short form a lot. And I think I write, in a kind of minimal way like that. And there's not that much to say on the subject over 5 or 10, 15 pages. And I think a lot of the stories that I love in the world are kind of short pieces like that too. But the morality question, I'm not sure how to answer. Maybe we can kind of like turn it over a little bit back and forth.
You mean Dennis?
Oh yeah, I mean that's just such a great like overwhelming question that I'm just a little stumped.
Well, I can't speak for Benjamin. I mean, I think Benjamin and I share a kind of interest in writing about extreme things, and I think we have a basic trust, perhaps in ourselves, in our own morality, that we don't feel like we have to pull anything back because Benjamin, I think, is an inherently deeply moral person, and I think most people that write about this kind of material are, which is why they allow themselves to go so far, because there's intuitively you know you won't go too far. I don't know if that's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems in the stories in Headless, as before, that sometimes the sentences seem, whatever their content, their sounds seem worked to the point that whatever is in fact being said, it's been made okay by the kind of goofy elegance. I know goofy is a word that you don't like. I'm sorry.
Oh, I like it.
Oh, okay.
A lot.
Oh, good. Of the sentence itself. And that it seems to me sometimes that what I'm watching is how well these vowels and consonants are played against one another, and that the amazement here is that someone would be thinking in terms of syllables and sounds at the same time that the subject is getting so extreme.
Mm-hmm. I remember there's a morality in a sentence and trying to just sort of like do it justice and push it to a beautiful spot and like that it goes to a mental place that you've never been and you didn't expect the idea to go. And I think it's fun to surprise yourself as a writer, and I think that's keeps you working every day.
Do the stories go where you want them to?
I'm not really sure where I want them to go. I think that they're a surprise to me, and even after I've written them, I'm surprised with the day's work, and I'm surprised with what comes out. Sometimes they're a little more in control like that, like I know where I want to go. But I really like not knowing. I like, you know, kind of writing and sort of falling and, you know, being like Alice in the hole and just like surprising myself.
The stories loosen themselves up by taking a pretty unconventional or not unconventional, infantile approach to bodily fluids. Because of the second section of stories called Marnie, there's this place where you get a perspective on that. The husband, the writer, is at home. The toilet has overflowed. His wife has gone shopping. He spent the day cleaning up, kind of horribly. By now, murk is dripping down the top of his computer.
Yeah, I think that was the fecality of it all. That's the title of that story. Marnie is the ski story, the death of a skier.
The section was called Marnie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Fecality, it was it's actually, you know, fairly true story.
Oh, well, all I meant was that the stories in that section, in Fecality, we've got the obdurate nature of plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
In Marnie, someone who's dead is dead, and, you know, it's not going to be with comic verve
mm-hmm.
that death is recorded. It's almost as if for the first time the stories in the second section are a reminder that there's a horrible world in which things have a brute and unavoidable presence, and that even in the disgust of the other stories that they offer freedom,
right,
that they're not about the world that can't be changed. They're about the world that's full of constant imaginative changing.
Yeah. There was a story in Demonology that sort of really affected me by Rick Moody. You know, I think one of the last story in the book where he writes about his sister. And I thought all the stories in the preceding that were just so over the top. And then that one seemed like it was basically a personal essay on the death of someone close. And it just floored me. I thought that was so cool. And I had written Marnie before that, but I don't know, it gave me a certain confidence to put a manuscript like that together.
The last paragraph in that story completely, Marnie, took me by surprise. I mean, it moves back from the character's death to a moment before she was dead, but off screen in the story.
Mm-hmm.
One's hearing her diving into water, and she's going to register as a distant splash. And the final section, which is a flashback, nevertheless feels like a weird, unavailable echo of something that happens later but is the final version of that disappearance, mm-hmm. you know? And so I sat there, you know, with the page open in front of me, kind of unable to turn the page because I'd been lost in time. And it's such an interesting fictional effect to have this character disappear after she's already dead
mm-hmm.
and register as, the way memory does, as a mere splash, mm-hmm. you know? I thought it was very beautiful.
Thanks.
Was that story particularly difficult to write or decide about? Because it's so different in its tonal register.
Yeah, it was totally different. I mean, like I was saying, I originally was thinking it would be maybe an essay, but I don't really want to write essays and publish things like that. And I had written, you know, it three times longer, and it had all this other parts to it, and it was very hard, and it took me a super long time, and I felt like I was never going to get over it. I read a lot of weird books related to it, even like The Things They Carry by Tim O'Brien, a Vietnam book, thinking like my experience of this death was like, you know, his Vietnam or something, and just trying to process this, and I just felt like I didn't want to really continue writing until I had written some kind of thing about that experience that was kind of that got it sort of right, and I thought it got it sort of right, but it was really it was super hard to do.
Now I'm with Benjamin Weissman, the author of Headless, published by Little House on the Bowery, an imprint of Akashic Press. And with him is the editor of this series, Dennis Cooper, who's also a fiction writer as well, and a well-known one, and one very much admired by me. Now, it seems to me that in this manuscript, by putting these reality stories in the second section, the conventional thing would have been to let the collection land, to end with a story like Marnie, but to encounter it in the middle of the book is an absolute astonishment, because it ends up telling you that the real world is not the world we're condemned to. We're not going to land in the unavoidable, unendurable real. To what extent is the ordering of this collection your influence, Dennis?
Totally, I think. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was looking through the work that Benjamin had given me for this book, and I just thought it was important. I think that, I mean, Benjamin's a very great writer, but he was known from Dead Dead Person as being a kind of comedic, outrageous writer. And it struck me reading through the manuscript that there were many, many qualities to his work that I thought hadn't been really recognized yet. And I thought that there were these thematic things running in them that could be isolated and combined, and then it would make you realize that there actually is quite a large range within Benjamin's work. And so that was essentially it, and these four thematic sections came up quite naturally. And as far as putting the Marnie section, the personal section, second, you know, a lot of that's just instinct, although I thought that it begins with sort of the most outrageous work in a funny way. And then to introduce that, I just felt like it created this warmth and this truth beneath the first section, which then reverberated out to the latter ones. Because when you get to the last section, it again becomes family, and those are like halfway between the outrageous stuff and the personal stuff. So it was just a matter of, you know, I'm interested in structure, and I thought that structure would be a complication in the book that would be an interesting addition to what the work gave you.
Now, Benjamin, one of the very few literary quotes in the book is a quotation from Artaud. And like other writers whom I know to be influences on you, Robert Walser, for instance, Artaud was literally mad. And Walser, although he said when he got to the insane asylum, "It's not time to write, it's time to be crazy," which I hope he said, although apparently there's no evidence, in fact, that anyone heard him say such a thing. But it's a great quote. But I remember a sentence in a story by Charlie Baxter. Guy's trunk full of books is found. The books are the kind of books that we all like to read. I don't remember whether he's in the hospital or jail or prison, but he says, "My luggage brought me here." And I just wondered whether you think on some level, because, you know, Artaud was a writer who was quite convinced that his writing was part of his insanity, that it was driving him crazy, and that he would go wherever it took him.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in any way obligatory?
I think most writers would agree with that their work takes them places, and that they're, you know, kind of guided by it and listening to it and sort of you know, pushing it along, and it's dragging them and it's pushing them. And but I think that, you know, writers need to be and, you know, work very hard at being kind of, you know, rational and thorough and very alive and sort of on point, as they say, and not so reckless. I mean, I think you want to sort of give yourself freedom for a lot of abandon, but to follow certain, you know, a certain voice and consistency, and you know, keep it lucid and you know, lively.
When people, though, read them, the stories, who are not writers, I know that when I was young and I found mad books, and I don't mean Mad Magazine, but, you know, Kafka and Beckett's Watt and certain books, I really did think that they offered an opportunity for a different kind of living. In other words, the books seemed there to offer the possibility to someone who was not yet adult, still young, and didn't know what would be required of me eventually, to live in a different way. And I do think that the power of books like this is that people who are not yet overburdened with responsibilities are reminded that a different life is possible. It may not be a pretty one. It might be full of randomness and insanity and heartlessness, but it is a freedom from the responsibility that eventually is going to grab everyone, whoever. And I wondered, you know, what your response to your readers' responses to the books are.
Wow, I don't really know what my readers think too much. I don't get a chance to really converse with them, or you only end up hearing what people enjoy, and I hear from some friends, and so I don't really know. I mean, I think I live a pretty ordinary life. You know, it's super similar to I'm kind of a jock, so I end up hanging around with a lot of people that ski and play tennis or something, or play basketball, and I think we're sort of like the same in a physical sense, and then in a mental sense, we're completely different. But it's my private world, and it comes out maybe in some of my speech and little things when we converse. But generally, it's I mean, being alive is being a human is about having just being inside your own head, and it works for me and keeps me loving being alive. And I think that my favorite books do that, the strange books, and I think that's why writing is super important to me.
I have been speaking to Benjamin Weissman upon the occasion of the publication of his wonderful book of short stories, Headless. It's a book that, as soon as you see Paul McCarthy's art on the cover, a fantastic eyeless bunny rabbit with a mannequin's body and a hose protruding and spilling, coiling over the floor where the genitals would be, you do get the sense that sense is going to be drained out through the body, that biology is the way of draining content and leaving you the head of a stuffed animal, which is, a way of saying what goes on in this fantastic book in which the head, as mentioned in the last story, can no longer be depended upon to guide one sensibly, that we're now in a realm in which, at best, the head is going to give faulty information. I thought it would be interesting to have Benjamin read the final section of a story in which a boy who's been warned by his mother, because rejecting advice seems to be what these stories do. Famous writing advice, parental advice. She's told him not to play near restrooms in parks. He's been given a tape recorder by a teacher and told to make a sound art project. He's done one in the restroom at the local park, and now he's come home to his mom, who is in the kitchen. This is Benjamin Weissman reading the final section from his story, Death by Toilet.
The mother lunged at him, knocking the phone off its cradle. The mother plunged the knife wildly and repeatedly missed the flesh of her son. The boy picked up the phone and struck his mother on the head. She dropped the knife. She fell to the ground dazed. The boy wrapped the phone cord around his mother's throat in the same manner that a cowboy ties up the feet of a young calf. She struggled to breathe. The mother said, "I have to set boundaries. A mother can't say yes to everything." At that precise moment, the father came home from work. He put his briefcase down and watched his son strangling his wife. "That's interesting," he thought, before realizing the severity of the situation. He ran across the kitchen and jumped on the boy and slapped him across the face. Then he hugged and kissed him and started to cry. The boy cried. The father unwound the phone cord from around his wife's neck. "Are you all right?" he asked. "I'm fine, honey," she said. "Mom tried to stab me," the boy said. The father said, "Everyone wants to stab everyone, son. But that doesn't mean there isn't love in the air, flowers in our hands, and benevolence in our hearts."
Benjamin Weissman reading from one of the last stories in Headless. I think that's brilliant, Benjamin. I love it, and I didn't realize reading it how extraordinarily sad it is. I hear these stories in my head, and I find them hilarious, but that mother is very frighteningly human. I had found her reading it as hilariously funny. And I guess that's what I'm forgetting about these pieces, that they veer in tone so quickly between the extreme and an ordinary situation of parenthood that is daily, just expressed with extremity, and the hilarious becoming the hysterical and the unfathomably uncontrollable. It's such an incredible thing to see comedy become modulated like that, so that the stories are no longer giving you an easy option of laughter. Has that been intentional for you, to do something with laughter other than allow it to provide release?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is what you said. I mean, I try to do it like that, but it's, you know, it's an intuitive thing, and I think it's, you know, that kind of mix is it's that scene. I don't know. It's hard to describe, but it seems like that is what is in a lot of experience, or at least sort of how I process it, or how you can kind of retell a story where there's little fragments of stuff like that. About what growing up is like and how kind of absolutely insane it is for parents and children to sort of like coexist when sexuality is introduced, and it's just complete pandemonium. And I think in the retelling, I just don't want to go for some kind of obvious thing. And I think, rereading that, it just reminds me again of just how kind of, like a tornado it is to sort of assemble things and think about, living with one's parents.
I've been speaking to Benjamin Weissman, the author of Headless, published by Little House on the Bowery. It's an imprint of Akashic Books. The book is available in paperback. It's quite an extraordinary collection of stories. With him has been Dennis Cooper, author and curator, editor of this series for Akashic Books. Thank you both for coming and talking to me.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
You can read an excerpt from Headless on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.